Should Socialists Support NATO Governments Sending Weapons to the Zelensky Regime? This was the title of the international discussion earlier today on December 4th, 2022, amongst Marxists organized by Reform and Revolution, RISE, and Lernen und Kampf. My name is Alex Stout. I go by they, them pronouns, and I'm a member of Reform and Revolution within the DSA, and I've just chaired that meeting. The panelists were Paul Murphy, who is a member of MORE in RISE, Ireland, and is a member of the Parliament for People Before Profit. Aaron Amaral is a member of the Tempest Collective in the US and part of the Ukraine Solidarity Network. Andreu Cole is an activist with Anticapitalistas in the Spanish state and a member of the Fourth International Bureau. And Bruno Magalhães is a member of the International Commission of MES in a revolutionary socialist grouping within PSOL in Brazil. We wanted to have this conversation amongst people who usually have a strong agreement in the tradition of the ideas of Marx, Lenin, Luxembourg, and Trotsky. We believe that this could be a valuable contribution to prepare us to intervene in this conflict and in the struggles to come as imperialist aspirations and conflicts increase in a world of economic, environmental, and social crisis. We think that there are very valuable views from comrades in the Ukraine and Russia that we follow and respect. We know of comrades from what we would call a Maoist tradition from Ukraine who came to similar conclusions as RISE, LIK, and RNR, or the Anticapitalistas. And we know about comrades from a broader Marxist background from Ukraine who strongly agree with Tempest and MES. For this discussion, though, we chose to focus on the basis of a more narrow understanding of Marxism and the forces internationally who represent those. We believe that all the panelists here, despite our differences, we have a joint tradition. So we want to discuss this issue with the more narrow question where those disagreements still exist, which would be, should we support or oppose in NATO countries the delivery of weapons to the Zelensky government in Ukraine? It's interesting to us that we can see very valuable contributions and comrades ending up with two different positions. We want to have this discussion in mutual respect and believe that we can disagree even strongly on questions of war and peace and still learn and listen to each other. We will have a lot of struggles in front of us where we will need to be working and fighting together. I also want to acknowledge up front that we did end up in this discussion with four cis male speakers on the panel, which was not our goal, and is something that we intend to avoid in future discussions. Without further ado, we'll jump to the opening statement of Paul Murphy from RISE in Ireland.
Thanks a lot, Alex. Thanks a lot to everyone who is attending the discussion, and in particular, thanks to our speakers for agreeing to participate in what I think can be a very valuable discussion. I want to start from the point of view of the massive war propaganda, which is underway and has been underway throughout most of this year in large parts of the globe. In Russia, obviously, our comrades are faced with immense repression and arrests for organizing protests, for resisting the war drive of the Putin regime. Tens of thousands of people have been arrested. The Russian population is being bombarded with propaganda about Nazis in Ukraine and so on. But in the West, it's important to recognize that we're also subject to a massive propaganda campaign. And I give you some good examples from the last one week in Ireland, a supposedly neutral country. So on Tuesday, the Taoiseach, the Prime Minister of Ireland, described the People Before Profit members of Parliament as, quote, puppets for the Putin regime. You know, an incredible slander of opposition members of Parliament as effectively fifth columnists, despite the fact that, of course, we have a record of opposing Putin much more consistently than Fianna Fáil, his party, does. It's because we oppose the participation of Ireland in military training missions of Ukraine. We oppose its participation in the NATO-led Ukraine Contact Defense Group, and we oppose the sending of military aid to Ukraine. On the same day, another member of the government party said we were on Putin's Christmas list. Then on Thursday, we were treated to a live address by the president of the European Commission. And she told us that, quote, in Ukraine, there is more at stake than the future of one country alone. Ukraine is fighting for freedom itself, for safe rule, for the rules-based global order. And this is the Irish example of what is happening across Europe. Huge increases in military expenditure, Finland and Sweden being quick marched into NATO, and with US hegemony over EU militarization being asserted. And in this atmosphere of propaganda and intimidation, I think we on the revolutionary socialist left have a duty to try to think clearly and objectively about what is happening. So at the outset, I'd like to say that this is a debate among revolutionary socialists who share many aspects of our analysis. And I say that to make two points. Firstly, because while this will be a sharp and quite critical debate, I presume, with significant disagreements, it is a debate happening amongst comrades. And secondly, because I'm assuming that we have agreement on a whole series of important ideas that therefore don't need to be proved. For example, that Putin is a right-wing authoritarian leader of an imperialist state which is not acting in the interests of Russian speakers in Ukraine or against Nazism in Ukraine, and that US imperialism and European imperialism and NATO are not a force for good or peace in the world. And when they talk about a rule-based global order, they mean a Western imperialist hegemony. Because of that, I think we don't need to debate whether there is an imperialist invasion of Ukraine by Russia and a legitimate and just war of national liberation by Ukrainian people against that invasion. I think there clearly is. I think all four speakers can agree on that. And in that conflict, to be clear, we are on the side of the Ukrainian people against the brutal invasion that they're facing. We should defend the right of Ukrainian people to self-determination. We should also support the right of minorities within Ukraine to self-determination, recognizing that that can only be done by the withdrawal of occupying troops and the right of all refugees to return. However, and this, I think, is where our analyses diverge. I don't think that this is only an imperialist invasion. I think it is also a part of an inter-imperialist conflict with Russia and its allies on one side and with US-led Western imperialism on the other side with the aim of trying to weaken Russia. And in this conflict, we think that revolutionary socialists should oppose both sides. So this is complicated. We have two intertwined aspects of this conflict, but this is the world we live in, with rival imperialist powers jockeying for position, national oppressions. It's a complicated world, and we have to deal with that complicated reality instead of ignoring it. The crux of the disagreement at an analytical level is whether this second aspect of conflict is present here. So as I understand from the article that was shared, the comrades from Tempest agree that there, quote, is an inter-imperialist conflict behind the war. The Executive Bureau of the Fourth International states there is a, quote, background of inter-imperialist strife. So both situated as a passive backdrop or context, not an active part of the war that we're seeing fought out. And fundamentally, I don't think that adds up or correlates to the facts that we see. Well before Russia's invasion, there was a clearly expansionist agenda of NATO. It expanded 800 kilometers eastwards since the fall of the Berlin Wall. It has had annual, very large military exercises on Russia's borders. It has positioned NATO battle groups and missiles in neighboring countries to Russia. And since the invasion, all of that has rapidly accelerated. So the number of troops under direct NATO control in Eastern Europe has gone from 4,000 to 40,000 in the space of less than 6 months. This is in addition to what the French finance minister described as total economic war against Russia, namely the extensive sanctions aimed at crippling the Russian economy and impoverishing ordinary Russian workers. There are extensive training missions for Ukrainian armed forces by NATO. And I think the most significant factor is the largest side, they say that this is the key thing, that without direct clashes, without direct involvement of US or EU military, there is no inter-imperialist conflict. There is only an inter-imperialist background to this conflict. But I don't think that makes any sense. You can find quote after quote from prominent European and US leaders saying, this is our war. Why don't we believe them when they tell us that? To just say there are no direct conflicts, that there's no direct involvement, inter-imperialist conflict, if there isn't a direct clash between troops, I think ignores the complexities of the world where proxy battles and proxy wars are very possible. It also results in a very peculiar paradox, given the nuclear-armed status of both Russia and NATO. So the comrades, I think, won't accept that we're in an inter-imperialist conflict unless they are actually shooting each other. But both sides know that if there is direct conflict, well, then things can very, very quickly spiral into a nuclear war. So they therefore find ways to have a conflict without directly shooting each other. It means the comrades would only recognize an inter-imperialist conflict when we could be hours or days away from a sort of nuclear conflict which would threaten all of humanity. So what are the consequences of that? For me, recognizing the dual character of the conflict means that as socialists in Western countries, we need to seek ways to support Ukrainians in their struggle against Russian oppression, that's a just struggle, while simultaneously opposing the imperialist agenda of the Western camp. That obviously means slightly different things in different concrete national circumstances. In Ireland, for example, I think it means welcoming refugees. It means calling for a significant increase in humanitarian aid. It means calling for cancellation of Ukrainian debt, a demand raised by the social movement in Ukraine. For example, we have put down a motion in the parliament in Ireland to do so and raised it continuously. It means calling to shut down the shadow banking system in the Irish financial sector, which is used by Russian oligarchs and oligarchs from other countries. But it also means strongly opposing the Irish government using this as an opportunity to drive militarization, against sending military aid to Ukraine, which is being sent to further the interests of Western imperialism, against participating in EU military missions, against participating in the NATO alliance of the Ukraine Contact Defense Group, and against the sanctions, which in reality are an instrument of war. Just want to finish with one point, which is, I think, a dangerous logic of the comrades who have the other position and ask them to respond, which I think the danger is if we accept that all of a sudden in this conflict, NATO, US imperialism can be a force for good after everything it has done in Iraq, Afghanistan over the last couple of decades or over the past 50, 60, 70 years, if we accept that here it can be a force for good, if we call for it to send weapons, we support it sending weapons, well, then do we not undermine our argument in future against militarization, against the undermining of neutrality in Ireland, or against the role of NATO in the US or whatever? Do we not undermine our principled anti-imperialist and socialist position, which I think we are all struggling for? Thanks.
All right. Thank you so much, Paul. Next, we will take Aaron Emeril. Go ahead.
Thank you, comrades, and I'll certainly take the 5 minutes later to respond to Paul and others. I want to start by thanking the organizers for the invitation, my fellow panelists. As I hope is clear, I'm a member of the Tempest Collective, which is a small revolutionary socialist organizing collective in the U.S., and I'm on the editorial board of our website. I'm also a member of a newly developing group in the US called the Ukraine Solidarity Network, which is starting to organize events and intervention, and which I hope you'll be hearing more about in the near future. 10 minutes is not a lot of time, but given the lineup, I want to explicitly acknowledge that these opportunities are incredibly, for exchanging debates on perspectives and strategy, incredibly valuable and important. But I also want to say, and given this is a thematically ties into my brief talk, that this is a debate amongst those of us outside of Ukraine. And it's important for us for this debate to be wholly informed by our engagement with and our listening carefully to our comrades inside and the democratic forces inside of Ukraine itself. We need to be centering the questions of what's happening inside Ukraine and those forces. Almost 10 months in, and the analytic starting point remains the same. In relation to the position of the internationalist, anti-imperialist, socialist left, Ukraine was subject to an invasion by Russia. I know Paul says this is a given, but it's important to think about the 6,000 dead Ukrainian civilians, the 10,000 plus soldiers that have been killed or injured, the 7 million refugees, the mass destruction of Ukrainian infrastructure, and I think the estimates of damage were already at $500 billion in May of 2022. I can't imagine what they are now. This is not even to speak of the impact in Russia, albeit incomparably less significant, but which has seen three times the casualties and an economy and a society upended by this pursuit. We believe, I'll speak of the political opening in Ukraine, but the political impact in Russia is also important in terms of our building of solidarity and is inversely sobering in terms of the consolidation of the authoritarian state there and the strengthening of essentially fascist currents in Russia. I'm glad to hear that it's taken as a given that Russia is acting in its own imperial interests. We agree that this is that there's an inter-imperial dynamic to this war, an active inter-imperial dynamic to this war. But the debates around defining imperialism, we don't think undermine the basic fundamental question, which is a democratic right that Ukraine has to defend itself and the right of national self-determination. And this includes the rights of Ukrainians to obtain arms from wherever they can. In a context in which the triumphant army of our Revolutionary Socialist Workers' Republic is not yet a reality, this is an important point. To stand with Ukrainians means fundamentally in this context, in this invasion, standing for their right to obtain arms. Otherwise, the gesture to solidarity, we believe, is meaningless. Again, the starting point here is clear and cannot be glossed over or hand-waved away. There is an obligation to unconditionally support the democratic right of Ukrainians to defend themselves. In particular, Ukraine has since 1991, been in the process of reestablishing a national identity, a contested process of nation building over centuries, but that has been inalterably interrupted and transformed by Putin's invasion. And it is important to recognize both aspects. First, Ukraine as a nation and the contested post-Soviet process against the chauvinism of both the Stalinists on the left and their cousins, the great Russian nationalists, who deny the nationhood of Ukraine. And second, the contested nature of the national project. Because one of the favorite gambits of those, maybe outside of this debate, but those including on the left, who'd sort of want to paint Ukraine with a monochromatic brush. Those people who deny the contested nature of the national project in Ukraine and say Ukraine is Zelensky or Ukraine is the Azov Battalion, Svoboda, et cetera. So they deny the existence of independent trade unions, they deny the existence of a Ukrainian left, deny the existence of popular organizations of women, LGBTQ folks, national minorities, who are not only voices in this process, but who overwhelmingly stand for the defense of Ukraine. The point here is not to deny the existence of the far right or nationalist elements in both Ukraine and Russia, but to say that there is much more happening in both countries. And given the history in Ukraine and Russia and in fact, most of Eastern Europe since the consolidation of the Stalinist counter-revolution in the late 1920s into the post-war period, the international left should be driven by a concern, a central concern, to build strong, lasting, and solidaristic ties to forces in those countries, in this case, in particular, Ukraine. So I'm going to speak both on a principle and a strategic basis. In principle, as I have already stated, our starting point is that with the Russian invasion, the central issue, the issue that has to be centered and cannot be waved away, is the basic democratic right of national self-determination, the right to defend oneself against a brutal invading army, and what it then means to stand in solidarity with those folks who are crying for arms to defend themselves. This includes the right of Ukraine to obtain weapons from wherever it can. While it is, of course, true, as is always the case between nation states and the imperialist world system, that the Ukrainian war is implicated in an active inter-imperial conflict, not passive, that just as Russia used the invasion as an ill-fated effort to strengthen its position, that NATO and the US and the EU are actively using the war as a pretext to strengthen theirs, and which has proven, yes, very successful. However, to simply call this a proxy war or a war between the West and Russia is to evade the reality of the national question and the basic democratic rights at issue in the war and what the forces in Ukraine, with whom we claim to be in solidarity, are asking for. The so-called Contra war in Nicaragua in the 80s was a proxy war, dreamed up and initiated by the US in nearly every aspect. This war is more equivalent to the Vietnam War. And insofar as we defended the right of the North Vietnamese and the National Liberation Front to obtain arms from wherever it could, including Stalinist China and Russia, despite the distinct imperial interests and active inter-imperial conflict that it represented, we still defended that right. The idea that the war in Ukraine can be reduced to a proxy war or can be reduced to an inter-imperial conflict is belied by both the last 10 months and what is increasingly clear to anyone paying attention over the last few weeks and months of the divergence of strategic interests between Ukraine and its main arms suppliers in NATO and the US. First off, NATO and the US have had every opportunity, every invitation to make this an active proxy war with the introduction of no-fly zones or otherwise active duty NATO troops into Ukraine. And this has been studiously avoided at every step. Biden's handling of the missile striking the Polish border is another example of how carefully the US in particular has been to avoid the direct confrontation. The head of the CIA last month spent significant time in Turkey laying the groundwork for a negotiated settlement that appears to be essentially over the heads of Ukraine. Macron's recent visit to Washington raises this prospect as well. The idea of a proxy war would imply a bilateral dynamic that does not fit the complex reality at issue here. Again, this is not to deny the inter-imperial dynamic, which is very real, but to deny its primacy. On any issue of any proposed ceasefire or proposed peace talks, the international left should be guided in the main by the voices in Ukraine. And again, I don't just mean Zelensky, but I mean the democratic forces from below, the left, the trade unions, the popular organizations. We should be in the main deferring to those voices on the questions of Donbas and Crimea, while unconditionally reiterating our defense of the democratic rights of minority rights, language rights, et cetera, as well as speaking our implacable hostility to Western imperialism and NATO and the EU, a line that's only likely to be heard if we're actually standing in active solidarity with the forces in Ukraine.
1 minute.
Sorry, what was that?
Oh, 1 minute left.
Okay. The strategic starting point for the international left, which is arguably at a historically weak ebb and facing resurgent forces of the authoritarian right, has to be the rebuilding of our own forces and recreating networks of solidarity and resistance from below in Ukraine and across Eastern Europe that haven't existed for decades. We have to be driven by the imperative to build an alternative to the imperial camps and to demonstrate that there remains an imminent popular democratic force that can stand against both the imperial camps and that can ultimately stand against the imperial system per se. For decades, the left thought itself forced to align with Moscow or Washington and devastating consequence to our project. The same dynamic in 1991, which reopened the process of national self-determination in Ukraine, and which has been violently interrupted by Putin's invasion, strengthened the prospect of the international left rebuilding itself across the region. In this moment, that requires our standing with them in the defense of the basic democratic rights, without illusions, but to give us an opening to engage our hostility to NATO and US imperialism and imperialism as a whole requires us stating that they have a right to get to gain arms from wherever they can. Thank you.
All right, thank you so much. Our next speaker will be Andrew Cole. Go ahead.
Hello, comrades. Thanks a lot for the invitation. Just to start with, I would like to make some preliminary remarks. In the first place, the need to stress the the need to address complexity before developing a finished position, the impossibility to understand any ongoing conflicts out of the framework of major historic events that preceded it in the last 30 years. Remember also that the armed conflicts are always very uncertain, and it's impossible to predict their outcome as they condense major complex political, military, economic, diplomatic dynamics. I think we must be very modest and admit our limitations. Relative lack of information, as Paul was pointing out at the beginning of his intervention, uncertainty, and have the ability to, if necessary, to correct our approach as the events evolve and unfold. I think that the left worldwide has to avoid two symmetrical errors in the approach to the war. One is, firstly, it's a minority, but it's important to blame Western imperialism exclusively, the role of NATO, especially US and British imperialism, for this war, excusing Russian imperialist agenda, the long national history of oppression suffered by Ukrainians, both under Tsarism and Stalinism, and the colonial nature of the Putinist invasion. There's a wide range of positions around this main trend, but I think, nevertheless, it's a problem. On the other hand, I think that characterizing the war exclusively as a national liberation war of the Ukrainians and even as an anti-imperialist struggle, ignoring the major economic, political, and military imperialist dispute around Ukraine that has been waged since the disintegration of the USSR, intensified since 2004 and openly exploded since 2014 onwards, is also a mistake. We think that both characterizations tend more or less consciously to condemn only one of the sides of these imperialist blocs in dispute and tend to forgive the faults of the other. This is very disturbing because it reminds me of the collapse of the European left movement in labor movement in 1914, when from one day to the other, we passed from condemning imperialist wars and a few weeks later, taking sides on one of the blocs in the name of the lesser evil, which, as Daniel Ben-Said used to remind us, is often the shortest path to major evils. At Anticapitalistas, we think that the solidarity with the Ukrainian working people and labor movement doesn't oblige us to stop condemning Western imperialists and NATO and their responsibility in this conflict. And in the meantime, we think that denouncing NATO must not stop us supporting the Russian opposition to the war and wishing the overthrow of Putin's autocratic regime by the Russian people themselves. In an article, the Ukrainian drama and the Russian roulette that I published at the beginning of May, I wrote, I quote, three tasks for the Western left merge. It must support, as far as it can, both politically and materially, the resistance of the Ukrainian people and their struggle for survival as a nation. B, it must support the military defeatism of the Russian opposition to the war. And last but not least, it must oppose NATO's objective, which is fundamentally that of Washington's, who really rules in its midst in this war, to prolong it as long as possible, ignoring its cost in lives and material destruction, while knowing that it's aggravating three major dangers in the situation in order of importance, that the delivery of increasingly lethal weapons will lead to an escalation that can degenerate into open war between NATO and Russia, that eventually, in a scenario of collapse of the Ukrainian state and economy and the strengthening of ultra-nationalist currents, through the dynamics of a protracted war, open to the door to the proliferation of ultra-right wing currents due to their significant endogenous strength and the arrival from around the world of thousands of volunteer fighters, etc. Nor can a chaotic fall of Putin's ultra-reactionary Bonapartism, brought about more by an external military defeat than by a domestic political defeat, be ruled out, given the relative weakness of the socialist opposition in the current phase, as opening the door to an openly fascist movement in Russia. So, end of the quote. I think that 7 months later, the escalation of the conflict is a fact in terms of weaponry and risks of open confrontation between Russia and NATO, especially after the missile incident in Poland, the risk of collapse of Ukrainian economy, explosion of debt and infrastructural chaos of supplies as a consequence of this escalation, which also includes the blowing up of the Nord Stream pipeline that's suddenly disappeared from the Western media, silence that, in my view, points to the American authorship, is also undeniable. And finally, what makes the whole situation extremely dangerous is that the fate of Putin's regime is totally linked to the outcome of this conflict. And unfortunately, his downfall doesn't necessarily lead to a better regime. Just to conclude about the weapon issues, I think, as anti-capitalistas, we think, in the meantime, that the Ukrainians have the right to acquire weapons to resist an imperialist aggression, but we oppose NATO government sending them because of the following reasons. I finish. It coincides with Western imperialist strategy to wage a proxy war against Russia, and imperialist tension and in amount imperialist tension with in Asia against China. It's lethal for the credibility of the anti-capitalist left, and it's intertwined with the rise of military expenditure in their own countries, and is contradictory to oppose social and economic consequences of war, and in the meantime support the arms that are fueling the conflict. Because it's absolutely simplistic to believe that we can end this war just by military means, when it has key political roots and a very complex origin, and the fact that it's not one single war. There's at least three intertwined wars. There's a civil war, at least since in some areas of the country since 2014, an imperialist aggression by Russia against the Ukraine since February, and a proxy war by NATO against Russia. I think that the continuity of the war can only lead to increasing catastrophes and to a reactionary spiral, not only in Ukraine, but also in Europe as a whole and in the world, and in a similar manner as it did in World War I. Some authors say that big powers are sleepwalking towards a similar scenario. You may say that this position is contradictory. It probably is, but it's not less than contradictory to the world situation itself. And we must accept our limitations, be aware of the weaknesses of the left in Ukraine, Russia, and worldwide, and focus primarily on the solidarity with the Ukrainian and Russian anti-capitalist left. The contrary can lead us to slip into the support of one of the two blocs and jeopardize our class independence and anti-imperialist tradition. Thanks a lot.
All right. Thank you so much, Andrew. And last, we have Bruno Magalhães. Go ahead.
Hi, comrades. Do you hear me? Yeah. Okay. Thank you so much for the invitation. Excuse me for my awful English. If I have some wrong word or misunderstanding, please ask me. Well, I'm Bruno Magalhães. I'm from the Socialist Left Movement. It's a myth, it's a acronym, a tendency of the Socialism and Liberty Party in Brazil. And we are part of the Fora International also. Sorry. Well, we here in myth, in my organization, we, since the beginning of the war, support the Ukrainian resistance. We have, like, as a matter of principle, because when the war starts, and we have some situation of war since 2014, but when the Russian aggression in this year starts, we took a position to support the Ukrainian resistance. We don't know nothing about the Ukrainian left in that time, but because we analyzed that the Putin regime and the Russian regime was like a Bonapartist and a fascist regime in an imperialist invasion. And the Putin speeches and the positions were against the existence of the Ukrainian state, of the Ukrainian nation. I think that the comrade Murphy first speech, it was very, very good to put the stacks of what we are talking about, because it's not about the Russian imperialism. We all agree that there's a Russian imperialism. We all agree with the problem of the NATO. But I think, and for that, we are from my organization, we have a Trotskyist tradition, and there's a very interesting article of Trotsky called Learn to Think, when Trotsky think about what will happen if the fascist Italia will support the independence of Algeria. And Trotsky said, well, against an imperialist power, even a democratic imperialist power, we need to support the rebels with all the measures, because we feel the means, because it's like we are Marxists and we have like concrete problems. The comrades, we have a socialist comrades in Ukraine, we have the social Neruki comrades, we have socialist comrades in Russia, the socialist left movement, the socialist movement, Russian socialist movement, sorry for the acronym. And it's when we talk about support the Ukrainian people, support the Ukrainian unions, support the Ukrainian resistance, but without the support of like material support of weapons, this is the truth. It's a tricky problem. I don't think it's easy, but you know, when the war starts, we don't have too much contact with the comrades in the Eastern Europe, but I was there in Poland 2 times this year, and I talked with comrades from Hungary, from Zikra, from the comrades from Razin, a lot of different traditions, but different leftist parties. It's not like comrades from Romania, and the problem of all of these comrades in the Eastern Europe, and I think another debate could be very interesting that invite this kind of comrade of these countries to be here with us to discuss. The problem was another problem. The comrades, we invite a comrade from the Social Neruk, the social movement from Ukraine, and I think today the most important leftist organization in Ukraine. And the debate was, we are totally against NATO, but we are facing challenges. You know, we are facing how to organize a strike against Zelensky when our cities are being taken by an imperialist aggression. And all of us agree that was an imperialist aggression. So I think it's not an easy question, but we need to choose concrete measures to face these questions. Okay. And for the Ukrainian comrades and for the Polish comrades, from all for the Finnish comrades, because if you ask for some Finnish or Polish or Romanian comrade about this situation, about the Russian imperialism in that place, they will talk about Belarus, Kazakhstan. There are countries in the Russian imperialist orbit that there's no independent left. Our comrades from Russia are fleeing from another country because it's impossible to be a socialist in Russia. It's different in Eastern Europe. So we don't want to defend that the model, the political system or the Eastern capitalism or NATO is not about this, but it's about how to organize their resistance. And this kind of happens. I think it's not easy to talk about it in Latin America, because we are facing the US imperialism, or each country in Latin America are facing all the day the US imperialism each day. And here in our region, the campist position, it's very, very strong, not only about the Eastern Europe, but we are facing a strong debate in the Eastern, in the Latin American left about Nicaragua. It's a dictatorship with, like, you can search about Nicaragua. It's not the issue, but it's very delayed, the debate. But at the same time, we think that the right of the Ukrainian people to resist against the aggression, it's like the minimal that we can, as when we support the Republicans in the Spanish Civil War, as the comrade Aaron said in Vietnam. So, but well, there's a question, a matter of inter-imperialist aggression. Well, there is a background of, as there is a background in Hong Kong, in Taiwan, but what was our position about the Hong Kong comrades that were crushed by the Chinese repression? But at the same time, the Hong Kong comrades went to the streets with not the Hong Kong comrades, but there's a lot of American people, American flags, and Trump calling. And it's a very contradictional situation. But we think that for our the framework of the situation, we need at the first to hear the comrades, the socialist comrades in these places, in Belarus, in Ukraine, in Poland, in the Eastern Europe. For us, this is the most, very most important thing, because they have the right to fight for your self-determination, and this right was guaranteed by the concrete ways, you know, by the forces. So this is why we support sending weapons to the Ukrainian resistance against Putin. We are against a no-fly zone. We are against each measure that could escalate the conflict to a nuclear war. But it's very important that it's very important that the Ukrainian comrades could have the right to defend their villages, their cities against the aggression. And they were winning. They took Kherson again. It's not like the retake of Kherson. It's like a winning for all of us, I think, you know, because it's like an aggression, and the comrades in Ukraine, and there's a lot of socialist comrades in the units, the civilian defense units, that they are facing the aggression. So I think this need to be our position, as we had a lot of another times in history. Thank you so much. And sorry, because my English is really, I don't know if I could.
Now, that was great. Thank you, Bruno. And thank you again to all of our speakers for being here and for participating in this and making this possible. Just a reminder of the format here, we're going to move back through the speakers one more time, just shorter contributions, 5 minutes apiece, so that they all have time to respond to the other points that have been raised before we open it up to the floor. Now, as they're speaking, please do message the More account that's been posting some notices in the chat if you want to get on Stack. And when you do, again, please include your name, organization, if that's relevant, your pronouns, and in particular, you know, especially we would like comrades from Ukraine, women, non-binary comrades to participate. If you are from Ukraine, we actually will give you a couple extra minutes. Rather than three, we'll give you five, so that we can make sure that we do hear more from people in that position. And so, you know, just want to encourage that. But let's go ahead and go back through the speakers in the meantime, starting again with Paul. Go ahead, 5 minutes.
Thanks a lot, and thanks, everyone. Maybe to start with the point about the need to listen to Ukrainians. I mean, I I agree 100%. I'm very, very interested. I will listen more intently and closely to the Ukrainian comrades who speak than to anybody else in this discussion. I agree. But it doesn't end the question, you know? Many people present it as, well, you have to listen to the Ukrainians. But obviously there is multiple opinions within Ukrainian society. There is the Zelensky position. There's people who call themselves socialists that are apologists for Putin within Ukraine. So what people really mean is listen to the Ukrainians who I agree with. That, in my opinion, in general, that's what they mean. So it doesn't, we can't just outsource our thinking. We need to 100% listen. I read very much all of the material coming out of Ukraine, but we still need to have a critical mind and be able to consider it and what our approach as international Marxists is, because of course there's a variety of views. Secondly, I mean, it seems to me that Bruno's argument and Aaron's argument about what the character of the inter-imperialist conflict is slightly different. The comrades can clarify. So Aaron was clear, it's an active inter-imperialist conflict. So I got it wrong in thinking that Tempest's position was that it was passive. Bruno's position is that it's a backdrop. But I would pose the question then to Aaron. Okay, so Aaron says to us, to simply call it a proxy war is to evade the reality of a national question. I agree. We're not arguing. I don't think me or Andreu are arguing this is simply a proxy war. I am saying there's two aspects to this conflict. One is a legitimate war of national liberation against a horrific imperialist invasion by Russia. The other is this inter-imperialist conflict. And so on the surface, it seems that Aaron and I agree that there's a dual character to this conflict. But then what conclusion does Aaron draw from that? What are you doing about the fact that your country, the US, the country you live in, is part of an inter-imperialist conflict? In fact, is one of the two driving countries, the US and Russia, being most involved. How are you opposing your own bourgeoisie in an inter-imperialist conflict? How are you implementing Karl Liebknecht's advice to that the main enemy is at home? So if there is an active imperialist, inter-imperialist conflict and you recognize that, surely there have to be some political consequences for that. Surely you have to oppose like your side and both sides in that inter-imperialist conflict. Whereas I don't see that, you know, in the actual political program that you put forward. You support the position of US imperialism to deliver weapons to Ukraine, even though they are, and you acknowledge, an instrument of inter-imperialist conflict. And I think, bluntly, that's a political mistake. Thirdly, just to be clear, again, I'm not, because again, Aaron kind of spoke in such a way as to suggest that we're against the right of Ukrainians to request weapons, to get weapons from wherever they can get them. I'm not speaking against that right. But what I am speaking is that as socialists in Western camp countries, in the US, in Ireland, for example, we have a duty to oppose our own bourgeoisie, their own, in the case of the US, imperialist interests. And that means opposing the sending of weapons, because they're not being sent because NATO has been transformed into a liberator, into a defender of, you know, national liberation. And they're being sent in the pursuit of the inter-imperialist conflict that NATO is carrying out and that Aaron acknowledges is an active part of this conflict against the US, and that we have a duty to oppose that. And that brings me to my final point, which is Bruno makes the point that, you know, it's kind of all very well for us to say we support the Ukrainian resistance, but without material support, it doesn't mean anything. But like, of all of the four forces that are here, none of us have the material resources to materially support in a very significant way the Ukrainian resistance. Let's be honest. We're not talking, no one here is talking about sending, you know, shipments of workers' arms to Ukraine. We don't even have any significant influence on whether NATO sends weapons or doesn't. So that they are currently sending weapons, Western imperialism, for their own purposes. That's happening, regardless of what our position is. The political choice we have is whether we give a left cover to that, or whether we say that's justified in doing that, or we oppose it and oppose our own bourgeoisie and expose what they're doing. And I think there is a consequence, a negative consequence, from going along with the idea that NATO is now an instrument for good, an instrument against oppression. It like undermines our sharp, in our minds, certainly the clarity of our political independence from our own bourgeoisie. It undermines our opposition to militarism. It undermines our opposition to Western imperialism. I mean, and I'm not attributing this position to any of those on the other side in this debate, but like Murray Smith has taken it to its conclusion. He wrote that it's irresponsible to talk now about the dissolution of NATO. I finished with that. Sorry.
All right. You're good. Thank you. We'll continue on with Aaron. Go ahead for your 5 minutes. Thank you. Oh, Aaron, you're still muted.
Thank you. Can you hear me? Thanks. Paul makes a series of rhetorical moves that I reject. You know, first of all, the idea that there's a distinction between a quote-unquote active inter-imperial conflict and a passive inter-imperial conflict doesn't make any sense to me. Look, any dynamic with amongst nation states at this moment, it, in some level or other, involves an active engagement of an inter-imperial conflict. The question is, where are we putting the priority? Tempest, the forces on the left that we're supporting are not in the U.S., speaking of NATO as a force for good. What we're doing is nor are we actively campaigning for NATO to be sending arms. What we're saying is that the priority in this context and the force of the dynamic in Ukraine, is one of national self-determination, the right of Ukrainians to defend themselves. Where the comrades in Ukraine, and I also reject the idea that, you know, when you listen to Ukraine, you're just listening to who you want to hear. I think it's very clear that there's a kind of overwhelming sense in Ukraine that there's a project, objectively a project of a national project at work. And that national project at work objectively includes forces across the political spectrum, including forces on our side, on the socialist left, including forces within the workers' movement that are speaking broadly in the same vein about the need and the call to defend themselves against a Russian invasion. So I think that's an objective fact. That's just not listening to who we want to listen to. And that's the predominant dynamic. And they're actively calling for the support for arms. And what we're saying is that we in the West cannot stand in opposition to that. That's not about actively campaigning or pretending that NATO's a force for good. In all manner of aspects, what we're doing is consistently calling attention to the questions of U.S. imperialism. If you look at our website, if you look at our actions over decades, so you know, I reject that there's of course there's a tension, but this is how politics is. It's an art and not a science. I'm glad that Bruno made reference to the Trotsky piece. People should read it from 1938. Learn to think. You know, one of the things he says is that an irreconcilable attitude against bourgeois militarism does not signify at all that the proletariat in all cases enters into struggle against its own national army. You know, I'm not much of one to defer to authority, but I think Trotsky's onto something here. There's a question of what's the predominant dynamic at work and what's going to be our position tactically, strategically. On this question, specific question of arms to Ukraine. And in order to get a hearing, as Bruno, I think, persuasively points out, in order to get a hearing amongst those comrades in Ukraine requires us to stand up, not just rhetorically, but actively to stand up for their right to get arms. Because if we're opposing those arms where we're sitting, then we're acting against their interests. We should be very clear. So, you know, in broad strokes, I agree with Andrew's 3 points. I think the questions of support Ukrainian people, support Russian resistance and the defectors, and oppose NATO. I think that's precisely right. The question is, how do we best achieve those aims? And so, you know, Yeah, I, you know, the The focus at this moment, and this goes to Andrew's point, the concern, I think there are very real concerns about what the outcome is going to be in terms of the kind of developing inter-imperial dynamic. It's scary. We're in a scary situation and we're in a very weak position as the international left.
1 minute.
This is why I focus, and I think it's important for us to focus on the strategic imperative to build the networks, to build the relationships with those forces in Eastern Europe who, if we're going to win, are going to have to play a role and be part of that project. If we're actively acting against their interests now, we're undermining that very thing, which is, I believe, the key, you know, an important key to unlocking that prospect, which is what, at the end of the day, we're relying on. Thanks, Kermit.
Thank you so much, Aaron. We'll go ahead and move next to Andreu. Go ahead.
Yes, very, very briefly. Well, I think that the US military aid to Ukraine is already going far beyond the annual Russian military budget. So this is something totally unprecedented since the American military aid that preceded their entry in Second World War. I think that major Western leaders, officials, and even spies have said explicitly that they are waging a proxy war against Russia to the last Ukrainian with their typical cynicism. I think this is a fact, but that doesn't mean it's contradictory with the fact that the Ukrainians are doing this not for the sake of NATO, but to defend the survival of their own country. The dramatic situation is that both situations are intertwined. And I think we've got to be very clear about this and avoid any simplification. I said earlier there was three conflicts at one, where each bully has done similar things to the previous one. So I was talking about civil war in some regions, then the imperialist invasion, and finally the proxy war of NATO against Russia. And this has been a Slavic Afghanistan for the Russians, equivalent to what Afghanistan was for the USSR, and probably will have a similar outcome. And at the time of the collapse of the USSR, some said, well, champagne, okay, but with a very important dose of Alka-Seltzer, because this can't lead to anything very progressive, given the dynamic of militarization of general society, Western Europe and the world at a world scale. And finally, material support to Ukrainians is an euphemism. When we're talking from the left, it's a political support to what our own governments are doing. Let's face it, I admit a contradictory situation, but we can't avoid reality. And I think that this has nothing to do, this interested support of the West to Ukraine with their liberation. And I think it's very offensive to compare it to the Civil War in Spain, in the first place, because in this case, the Spanish Republic had no Western supply of arms, precisely because it was a progressive government. And I'm absolutely convinced that at the time, France and Britain were totally aware of that. And that's why they denied the arms to us. And in the same manner as the US or the EU denied any military support to the Syrian democratic uprising at the beginning of the Civil War, for the same reason, it was progressive at first. And I think that, I really think that they only support reactionary regimes that develop their own interests. And I really think that bourgeoisie has a lot more means than we have in the labor movements in the left and the far left to assure these interests are being applied. And I really think we've got to be more modest about our capacity to understand what is actually going on the Ukrainian arena.
All right, thank you so much. We'll move on to our last speaker before we open it up to the floor. Go ahead, Bruno.
Well, thank you, comrades. I think the first matter is, I think the debate's not about what we really can do, because we are all weak in our countries, in the whole world, but it's about our principles matter, you know, because we were against the no intervention committee in the Spanish Civil War too. And I think when we, well, imperialism is not a, it's a system. It's not a geopolitical board. So there's a the feedback, the, each imperialist country, they had like a feedback relationship among them. So when we think about, we cannot, what I need to say is, when we go to the concrete way, when you think about the Ukrainian comrades and how they can resist the aggression, and all of us agree that it's an aggression, the only concrete way to resist the aggression, it's the by taking weapons from the countries that produce weapons. Well, and for me, this is a concrete thing, because when we think about the, well, the socialists in Ukraine, and they, that comrades think about what the socialists in Belarus, what the socialists in Kazakhstan and Uzbekistan, all the Central Asia, in all the situation of that comrades in the military dictatorships, and in with the developing of the with the advance of the Russian army, that could happen in Ukraine, because what we are facing now in Donetsk and Luhansk are like military dictatorships, and there's a lot of features of ethnical cleansing in Crimea and the Eastern Ukraine with the Tatars and other minorities. And well, when you think about that, and that the Ukrainian comrades are fighting against imperialist power, and for me it's like a principal matter, it's very clear that we need to defend with all the ways, we need to defend the right of these comrades to defend their country. It's not because, well, as I said, if we talk with comrades from Socjalnyruch, with comrades from Razin in Poland, with comrades from a lot of organizations in Eastern Europe, leftist organizations with different traditions, the problem was not the NATO. The problem is like what we will do with the Russian imperialism, and how we can, as internationalists, answer the comrades. Like we can't wash our hands. You know, I'm sorry. I have a few words in English, but we need to have like a concrete position for this comrade. You have the right to defend your country. If the US imperialism try to invade Brazil, I will defend my country, the self-determination, with the Bolsonarists, with the far right, you know. And this we can talk about, the because we were talking against an imperialism, as Trotsky said, against the French imperialism in Algeria, as we can say in a lot of kinds of imperialism, as we can say in Argentina, when a lot of comrades defend the Argentinian Liberation War in Malvinas against the British imperialism. And so for me, it's, we are talking like about a, it's not only about a geopolitical issue, it's about a principal issue about how, well, we are talking there, Irish comrades in the debate, you know, there is a war of liberation in Irish, in Ireland about, and this is not about to be what kind of government is in England, what's the interests of the people who support the Irish independence. It's about like the self-determination of these peoples. And this is why we think that, and I agree totally with the 3 points of the Fourth International that the comrade Andrew said, but I think that for me, this was part of a broad movement to support the Ukrainian resistance and to support the Russian resistance too. Because, and to finish, because we don't talk about it, but we could face an internal movement in the Russian regime that could be the important development for all the situation, because the Russian dictatorship, we cannot talk a lot about that, but it's happened internally.
Thank you so much, Bruno. Sorry to cut you off a little bit there, but just trying to keep the time for everyone. All right, so now it is time for us to open up to the floor, and then at the end of it, we will have a chance to go back through our panelists this time in reverse order to get a chance to kind of wrap up. Our first speaker from the floor will be Denise Pilash, who is in the social movement Ukraine. So we'll have 5 minutes to speak. Go ahead, Denise.
Thank you for giving me the floor. Hello. So I'm from Socialny Rukh, from social movement, the Ukrainian socialist organization. Sorry, I'm without a camera because we have blackouts due to this constant Russian missile attacks that are now specifically targeting infrastructure, civilian infrastructure objects. Effectively, their goal is to blackout us, to freeze us out in the conditions of winter, and albeit the workers of emergency services and energy sector, they are performing miracles to restore these energy grids and power plants. We still have to these schedules of blackouts. Yes, actually, we are now in a very harsh situation after all these months of a very brutal war, when entire cities and towns, especially in Donbas, were wiped out by the Russian army. And we had probably the death toll of civilians is much, much higher than it's estimated now. So in this situation, our organization and other Ukrainian socialists, anarchists, unionists, we have to perform different tasks on many levels. So first of all, lots of comrades have joined armed resistance. Lots have joined different humanitarian voluntary networks. So we are trying to do our best to help those who are in need, who have been most affected by the war, those who had to be displaced persons. And actually, again, the number is higher than not only those who had to leave Ukraine, but also those who are internally displaced, who had to relocate to safer parts of the country. And at the same time, obviously, there is no ceasefire in class warfare. So in any such kind of situation, any ruling class will grab it in order to curb social and labor rights and to expand their own agency. So we also have to oppose those antisocial measures that have been taken by the neoliberal MPs and neoliberal ministers in the government. So it's a task of multiple levels of resistance. And actually, I want to make a counterpoint to what was said, that there is no way of material support of from labor movement, because actually it is, and comrades from all over the places, from different leftist parties, from left bloc in Portugal to left alliance in Finland, from different internationals, from labor unions, from networks that are called the European Network of Solidarity of Ukraine and International Labor Coordination of Solidarity and Struggles, they have been helping their comrades materially with different goods and different humanitarian aid, with not just political support, but also concrete material support as well. So this is a very solidarity that can be feasible. So we shouldn't just say that there is no way for labor movement, international labor movement, to support its comrades and in general the working class in Ukraine. Getting to this question, it's the working class of Ukraine that is now bearing the main burden of the war, that is waging this war actually by defending their right to exist And I would say that more than 90% of working class people in Ukraine, they will be completely united in that simple notion that in order to survive in when we have this existential threat of being exterminated, because like the Russian officials, Russian MPs, Russian propagandists are now very cheering about an entire country being frozen to death, and not just the direct casualties of their imperialist aggression, but also indirect, because you have people in hospitals who are dying without electricity and so on. So in this context, I have something like a question, suggestion, because like Comrade Andreu like said that like they are for the right of Ukrainian people for self-defense, but at the same time, like against delivery of weaponry. And again, it's a myth that United States has thrown a military hardware to Ukraine that is more than the Russian defense budget. It is not. The majority of like people in the Ukrainian armed forces, they are
so sorry, still. Dennis, can I ask you to wrap up?
Yes. I'm going to the point. They are fighting with the old Soviet arms, and there is no bonanza of Western arms, and we're still in desperate lack, for instance, anti-aircraft, anti-missile systems, just to protect the civilian population from this like terror attacks by Putin's Russia, and like to Comrade Paul, whom I deeply respect, because a decade ago, when the in Kazakhstan, the local dictatorship, the Nazarbayev regime massacred the oil workers in Zhanaozen, and he was in the European Parliament denouncing it and spreading the truth. At the same time, when many Stalinists were like playing this game that, oh, it's the labor movement in Kazakhstan is some kind of proxy of Western, you know, Western intelligence and so on. This was the position of the so-called Communist Party of Ukraine, for instance. About like again this position, how do you suggest Ukrainian people now to defend themselves with what? Where we should obtain these arms? And just a modest
one
proposal.
More time, I'm sorry, if I can ask you to wrap up last sentence here.
Yes, the last question. A modest proposal, maybe. If we want to have a very radical anti-establishment position, maybe you should say that it's better for these Western arms, because it's again used as a pretext to like to multiply the military industrial complex. So maybe it's better to demilitarize the Western militaries by sending these arms to those who are under other imperialist attack, like Kurds in Rojava or Ukrainians, than to give them to sell them to some Arab sheikhs who Saudis who will then massacre Yemenis. So maybe you can have both in this position, both aspects.
Thank you so much for coming in and offering that perspective, Denise. I do hate to limit your time, but we have a full stack at this point. We have, and actually I'm saying this for the benefit of everyone else who might want to come on at this point, the stack is full, my apologies. We won't be able to get through everybody, but we'll move on to the next person and just try to hear from as many people as we can. So next would be Anne McShane. Go ahead and 3 minutes for Anne, thank you.
Okay, thank you. So, so basically I have a number of questions. First question is to all of the panelists. The European Union and the UN are setting up a tribunal to prosecute Russia for alleged war crimes. And obviously this is something that NATO is also very interested in and very pleased about. What do you think about this? Do you, if you're like Paul and those who are against NATO involvement, do you also condemn this? Which I think you should. The second point is about the question of self-determination. where do you think the demand for self-determination will lead in the current period? And do you think that national self-determination is an absolute? Third question, if imperialism is not primary, then why are Biden and Putin planning talks? Fourth question, do you think the current situation is a prelude to a war against China? And finally, do you think that the current situation has a feeling of pre-First World War about it? Okay, so I've tried to be succinct there. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Next up, we have Philip Locker. And then after that, just to give people a heads up, we'll have Evelyn Kay and then Hector Salazar. So go ahead, Philip.
Thank you. Well, I wanted to speak about the role of socialists where I'm based in the United States. And this is obviously the US is a very major actor in this conflict. And we're in a situation where in the US, we have a rarity in recent decades. We have four self-described socialists and members of Democratic Socialist America in the US Congress. What position should they take? What should they do? And in my view, as I'm a member of Reform and Revolution, it's a Marxist caucus in DSA, I think they need to speak, yes, very clearly being 100% against the Russian invasion and occupation of Ukraine, to make crystal clear their solidarity with the Ukrainian people and their resistance, their solidarity with the Russian anti-war movement. But also to make clear that's not the whole story. They need to speak loudly and clearly about the huge role that US imperialism is playing in this conflict. It has been mentioned in the discussion, the US has provided over $90 billion in aid to Ukraine, more than the entire budget of the Russian military. We need to point out this is not being done. The US government has and is in no way playing a progressive role. It is a totally reactionary force. And we can point to their blatant hypocrisy in Yemen, in Palestine, in Iraq, and Afghanistan. The only reason they are spending $90 billion is to pursue their own imperialist interests. So I think the role of socialists in the US is to speak out. And that starts also with our most public representatives in Congress to say, to make those points, to call for the cancellation of all US and foreign debt to Ukraine, but also to have the to be unambiguous that they should vote loudly and clearly against the military aid and weapons to this right-wing, pro-capitalist, pro-NATO Ukrainian government, and to help the Russian anti-war movement, to be a voice to call for withdrawing US troops from around the world and closing down US military bases. But let's start first and foremost in Eastern Europe. That would be an enormous assistance to the Russian anti-war movement for there to be a loud socialist voice in the US saying there's no, the US has no business with its military bases and troops in Europe, and the US needs to withdraw from NATO. That would be an enormous political assistance to the struggle against Putin and his right-wing pro-capitalist authoritarian regime in Russia, and would help give a direction to the Ukrainian resistance on a left-wing socialist direction rather than a pro-NATO, pro-imperialist direction, which it's being channeled into by US imperialism currently.
Thank you so much, Philip. Go ahead, Evelyn. Oh, and if I can ask when speakers come on, just like Philip did, if you can mention your political affiliation when you do, that would be appreciated. Go ahead, Evelyn.
Hi, my current political affiliation is with the DSA Labor Branch, and I'm also active in the District 37 Union Progressive Caucus. I strongly, completely have the opposite position of the last speaker and appreciate the comments of Denise Pilatch. If I make any mistakes on information, I'm not an expert on details of the Ukraine as I wish I was. The rise of the authoritarian, white supremacist, far right, as signified by Putin, is not simply an issue for Russia. It's a global issue. And my position is that Ukraine has to win, which I think is the position of the masses of Ukraine itself, because a defeat for Ukraine would not only mean the extermination of the Ukrainian identity, the expansion to already unthinkable numbers of a genocide or a crime against humanity happening in the Ukraine, with children being transported, Ukrainian children being transported in mass to Russia to be adopted by Russians, with Ukrainians deported to Russia to be put in so-called denazification camps. None, this discussion was sort of like lacking the fact that the struggle that's going on in Ukraine is really central, not only for the life or death of Ukrainians now and in the future, but for what's going to happen globally. And somebody like Putin has the possibility of being defeated now, whereas calls for abolishing NATO and so forth can be rhetorical statements made, but that's not going to happen now. And by that is not going to be of any aid to the Ukrainians, because they will all be dead with that position opposing their right to get arms from wherever. And I would even, I really liked so much what Aaron had to say, but I would disagree with the idea that we can't, that revolutionary socials can come out and say, yes, we are actually for, we are actually for arming of Ukraine. I don't know of any national liberation struggle where fighters didn't look for tactical support, for armed tactical support from one imperialist side or the other, taking advantage of the fact that, yes, there's always an inter-imperialist conflict going on. Should it turn into a proxy war, I think we should withdraw support. But it's not a proxy war now. What it is now is a genocide and a fight for national self-determination. That's it.
Thank you so much, Evelyn. Next, we have Hector Salazar, followed by John Molyneux. Go ahead, Hector.
Hi there. I'm with the Black Alliance for Peace Solidarity Network. I just want to say I really don't understand all the confusion. I've been an anti-war activist since Desert Storm 1 back in the 90s. We used to understand on the left that war is bad, simply. We should be protesting in the streets against war and our government's involvement in it. It's been mentioned that the United States has sent $100 billion in aid to Ukraine as our country rots with every possible problem, you know, facing it. And the reason that the comrade is not seeing it on the battlefield over there in Ukraine, as he just talked about, is because it's being siphoned off. You know, Ukraine was the most corrupt country in Europe. It was known. And you know, it's going to organizations like FTX were siphoning it up back to laundering it back to the Democrats. It's incredible that the Democrats had to debate for like 2 years about the Build Back Better bill, but they can send billions overnight to Ukraine again and again. We can't make Ukraine agree to the Minsk II agreements, but we can control what we advocate for. The way I advocate for more war, the military-industrial complex, or do we advocate for peace, diplomacy, and negotiation? By the way, the most powerful weapon the United States could have exported to Ukraine would be diplomacy, because that would have left, you know, diplomacy and negotiation in good faith would have left Ukraine unscathed. A year into this, approximately, you know, with millions of refugees, blown out or wasteland cities, hundreds of thousands dead. You know, the people that talk about Russia must be defeated no matter what, they are missing the internationalist perspective. The internationalist perspective is this. This is not just about Ukraine. This is about the globe, the planet. This could lead to the evisceration, the annihilation of humanity. I say no war, but class war. And if you want to look at somebody who was about diplomacy, look at Lenin and look at Brest-Litovsk. The Germans were invading and he was willing to negotiate. So, you know, before I get cut off, that's kind of the gist of this. I could talk a lot more about this, but thank you.
Thank you so much, Hector. Next, we have John Molyneux, followed by Sam Friedman, and then Stefan Kimmerle. Go ahead, John.
Thank you very much, and thanks to all the speakers. I'm a member of People Before Profit, like Paul Murphy, and the Socialist Workers Network in Ireland. And I'll say straight away that I support the side of this debate represented by Paul and by Andrew. But I want to make one general point and then raise some questions. First of all, I would warn against, particularly among comrades in this way, using what I would call emotive arguments about the suffering of the people of Ukraine. Of course, the people of Ukraine are suffering terribly, but that's true in any war, that the people suffer terribly. And it doesn't determine the position of socialists. So I don't think this war, I worry about the extension of the term genocide. All wars kill people and kill ordinary people. This is not more genocidal than what's happening to the Palestinians or what's happening to the people of Yemen and so on, supported in those cases by American imperialism and so on. So I just warn against that. I've got some questions, which are to all the speakers. One is parallel, I think, to a point that Philip Lockhart made. Zelensky was invited to speak to the Irish Parliament. He was given a standing ovation by almost everybody in the Irish Parliament when he did. Paul Murphy and other People Before Profit, TDs, that's members of Parliament, had to decide how to respond. How do people think they should have responded in that situation? Second question, whether American imperialism is giving 100 billion or 90 billion or less billion in arms, they are giving a lot of arms to Ukraine on a huge scale. What do the speakers think their motives are? I don't just mean generally imperialist. Do they have concrete aims that they want to achieve in this war in Ukraine? And if so, what do you think they are? And my last point is, what do you think the implications of this debate are for future situations? We hear a lot of analogies with the past, but what about if there's conflict in the South China Sea or conflict over Taiwan and so on? Do you think this what's going on in Ukraine has implications for future inter-imperialist conflict of that nature? Thank you.
All right, thank you so much, John. Next we have Sam Friedman. Go ahead, Sam.
Hi, Sam Friedman, People's Center for Disease Control, Tempest, and various other groups. Since 2010, I have been working with a lot of people in Ukraine on AIDS prevention. And I've worked with many Russians as well on similar things. And one of the things I was very struck by was I was working with people, particularly in Ukraine, who by all rationale should have been on the left, given their background, their interests, their values, and everything else. And they weren't. They had come convinced that Stalinism is what socialism meant, and they were against it. We all know that. But so I ask myself at this stage, during the current struggles in Ukraine against Russia, how do we help people in Ukraine, and I would add also Russia, to develop a respect and a serious liking for the left? You don't do it by saying we don't want arms to reach the Ukrainians. You say arms should reach the Ukrainians. Yes, the United States is a bunch of shits as a government and does horrible things. Get the weapons, keep them, use them against Zelensky if that becomes necessary later on, and all of that. But what we're going to see, assuming we don't annihilate ourselves, is that the kinds of mutual aid organizations that Denise was speaking about are going to be very important in the post-war Ukraine. And we want to have established the ties with them so that they can be effective on the left and are willing to listen to the left and be part of the left. Because what we've got to do above all is end the period where we say we have no material weight on anything. We need a real left. And in some countries around the world, we do have one, but there are very few countries. And I think that this kind of a conflict is exactly when the situation is open. People are thinking about many things. They are seeing that their government is screwing the workers in Ukraine and also in Russia. And under these circumstances, what we do can be listened to and taken seriously, whereas 10 years ago, it wouldn't.
Time.
Thank you.
Oh, thank you so much. Next, we have Stefan, and we'll then take Tristan Jones, and then Nikos, and then unfortunately after that, we'll have to close stack, but I can read out a couple of questions that we've been sent as well real quick. Go ahead, Stefan.
Yeah, hello. Thanks a lot for this discussion. Thanks a lot for the comments who participated in that. My name is Stefan Kimmerle. I'm a member of Reform and Revolution and Marxist Caucus in DSA. I live here in Seattle in the US. And I generally agree with Paul and Andreo. And I think our job here, as Philip outlined in the US, is to stop Biden and the Democrats' intervention in this war. I think we need to fight within DSA to either urge the four DSA members in Congress around AOC, Rashida Tlaib, and others to vote against Biden's and the Democrats' intervention in this war, or at least to clearly distance DSA from that stance. So that's where I'm coming from, but I also think that there are very valuable arguments from comments here in this debate. And I thought that when Aaron brought up the example of Nicaragua and Vietnam, that these are strong arguments. I would, for example, also add Rojava in Syrian Kurdistan, where the US did for some time actually deliver weapons. And I would not have urged AOC to vote, or other DSA members in Congress, to vote against weapons for Rojava, for the YPG there. And I think there are differences, but there are also other examples, like the whole questions of, while I would absolutely, I stood with the Iraqi resistance, I stood with the Afghani resistance, but I would not have been in favor of sending weapons and supporting sending weapons to those governments, Saddam Hussein or the Taliban. There is a difference, and I'm able to stand with the Iraqi resistance without politically, militarily, or in any other way supporting Saddam Hussein or in Afghanistan, the Taliban. I think that is the question. It's not, we try to generalize here, we try to learn also for future conflicts and find our way while defending working class principles there. I think we need to speak about the forces. Who gives the weapons, with what intention, and who receives the weapons? And is there a contradiction that can be exploited for some time? We still, in the case of Rojava, shows very clearly that you've got to warn that the US imperialism only has its own interests there. And this is short-term, but you can accept such a situation for some time. The character of the Zelensky government, in my view, is also crucial. And there I agree that it's simplified, that it is not a government of fascists or Nazis or whatever, but what is it? It's a pro-capitalist, pro-NATO, pro-Western imperialist government that was brought in 2014 in this battle over imperialist spheres of influence, a government waging a war against the Russian minority in the east of the Ukraine, which has in its character then the support from the US for such a pro-capitalist, corrupt regime in Ukraine, which is pro-NATO policies, has an impact
Time.
That is not comparable with Nicaragua or Vietnam. I can't go into detail now, I'm sorry. I've got to wrap up here, but I think that's a key to look at also. War is the continuation of politics without a means. There's a rupture, but still, what are the
Sorry, Stefan, we do have to move on. I apologize for the limited time here, but we've got just enough time to take two more people. If you can try to keep it short because we are over, that would also be appreciated. Next, we have Tristan Jones. Go ahead, Tristan.
All right, I'll do my best. Hello. Hi, I'm Tristan Jones. I'm a returned Peace Corps volunteer. Otherwise, it's not important. The point I want to make is that I feel like there has been a terrible misreading of the moment and a real overemphasis on a lot of the wrong issues by a lot of people on the left in this crisis. To make a clumsy analogy, I think too many people have been framing this like it's Iraq or Afghanistan instead of something like international development or climate change. And what I mean by that is they take the fact that Western governments are saying a lot of things and making a lot of commitments as if they're actually going to follow through on all of them. And instead of arguing for doing more and trying to be more involved and get more aid and more help, they're instead taking the conservative position that we ought to do less and spend less and try to solve everything with words alone. And I think it's a real shame. I mean, we could have had, we could be living in a time where the left was holding government's feet to the fire to follow through on their commitments, to actually deliver the aid that's been promised, and to be real open friends to the people of Ukraine. And instead, there's been a lot of equivocating. And it comes from a good place, I know. It's overthinking. I mean, people are going in circles and they're arguing themselves around to the position where they're getting upset about a gas pipeline, you know, instead of about people who are dying every day. And when you look at things in the practical terms, what is the impact you're actually arguing for? You know, if things happened the way you wanted them to happen, if we stopped sending arms through NATO, what's the practical impact of that? And the practical impact of that is more death, a longer war, and the people of Ukraine suffering more. And, you know, NATO exists. It's not going anywhere anytime soon. It's the best tool we have to try and provide these things. We have largely conservative governments that want to maintain their own military stockpiles, right? They're happy to send surplus material to Ukraine, but they don't want to dig into things that would cut. We could be arguing that they send more and it would do real good. It would save people's lives. But instead we're arguing, oh no, this will support the Western imperialist power. And we get so wrapped up in the terminology of socialism or of leftism that we fail to reckon with what's happening right now in the real world. And how is it impacting the people who need help? And that's what we need to focus on and what I think people should be focusing on. And so I would ask that everyone get out of their ideological lens for a moment and look at how can we use our voices to advocate for things that will do some good. And we can do that people can do that from the left. And if you're in politics to solve problems, then that's your job, not just to make a grand statement or to not clap for a wartime leader. It's to look at how can we make sure that, for example, sanctions aren't being dodged. You have a bunch of giant businesses and you want them to not be sanctioned for doing business with Russia. They're actively trying to dodge sanctions.
I'm sorry, we have to move on to the last speaker. We've just got a little bit of time here. Go ahead, Nikos. Thank you.
Okay, comrades. I'm Nikos. I'm based in Greece. I'm a member of Ξεκίνημα and an internationalist standpoint. Just, you know, some short comments since the time is very limited. One question I have is, you know, we're speaking about left forces inside Ukraine. And my question is, do these forces fight for the overthrow of the Zelensky government? Or they subdue themselves to Zelensky's leadership? Because for me, that is, you know, a crucial figure. It was mentioned that, you know, how can we organize strikes when there is a war? Of course, it's very difficult. And I, you know, hugely appreciate the efforts of the comrades, you know, fighting in this horrible situation. But the Bolshevik tradition was exactly that they tried to organize the overthrow of the Tsarist government in order to achieve peace. And actually, in my view, the only way to actually achieve peace or to stop the slaughter, because at this moment of time, it's a battle, you know, between huge forces that will not stop until they are forced to, is actually to overthrow them and that is, or weaken them at least. And that should be, in my view, our duty, both in for the people in Ukraine, but also for us in the Western world. And another question I would have is, you know, comrades advocate for sending arms. And my question is, how many arms? So according to Financial Times, there's the biggest arms push since the Soviet Union fell? You know, how many more arms should we send? And if this is going to solve anything, you know, and then should we also advocate for sending nuclear arms to Ukraine in order to finish off Putin? Is there an end to this? And then another question I would have for speakers is they you know, we all agree that, you know, Ukrainians have a right to exist, but do we also agree that the people of Donbas, the Russian speaking population of Donbas, do also have the right for self-determination, to you know, to leave Ukraine, and also do they have the right to get arms from whenever they could find them? And one last, you know, question for Comrade Bruno from Brazil. I don't know if it was a split of the tongue. He said that Putin is a fascist regime. Is this, you know, according to which kind of analysis can we characterize, you know, the Putin regime as a fascist one? Because it's different from, you know, totalitarian capitalist regime. Fascist, according to Marxist, has a very unique characteristic. So that's all. Thanks, comrades, for the discussion.
All right. Perfect timing. Thank you. I just have a couple questions that I can read out real quick before we turn it back over to the panelists to wrap us up. We have Sam Carliner, him from Left Voice, says, Bruno references Trotsky's Learn to Think, but in this essential text, Trotsky justifies sending weapons to national liberation struggles only in scenarios where the working class has already established its leadership, independent from capital. This is not the case in Zelensky's Ukraine. My question, do panelists who advocate for imperialist weapons shipments to Ukrainian forces see it as a necessity that these forces be organized as an independent working class force, as Trotsky did? And if so, how do they see class independence currently existing or possibly developing in Ukraine? Boris R. asks, are actually leftists, socialists, working class getting weapons when the US is sending to Ukraine? Thank you. And Kay Azure asks, in the Spanish Civil War, we demanded arms for the Spanish Republic. Wasn't that an anti-imperialist position? And then turning it back over to the panelists, 5 minutes again for each of them, but we'll go in reverse order. So starting with Bruno, go ahead and take it away.
Okay, it's a lot of issues, comrades. Let's try. My position is not an easy position, but I'm trying to face the concrete problem. I will return to this because I think that's our pivotal question. Because what's our advice to the Ukrainian comrades, to the Denis Pilish and another comrade that are now Ukraine today's revolutionary socialists? It's to surrender, it's to flee, or it's to resist. All of us agree that the Ukrainian comrades have the right to resist. So if the comrades have the right to resist, we go to the second question. It's with what guns? Comrade Denis said very well that there is already a solidarity network to support the Ukrainian workers. But this is not the necessary to face the Russian weapons, the Russian army. In the first round, the first weeks of the war, the power of the courage of the Ukrainian people made that the Russian, the Putin, don't achieve what he needs. That was like a total defeat of Ukraine. But in this first weeks, the Ukrainian army and Ukrainian resistance became empty, and they need more support to maintain the war. So for me, this is why I'm always talking that it's a principal question. We need to defend the right of the comrades to resist with meanings, with material, with concrete ways to resist. This is why we defend the sending weapons. Well, a comrade Nico said about, we don't defend like no flight zone. I said about it. We don't defend nuclear weapons. We defend, as Denis said, Denis are asking for defensive weapons like against the shelling, against air bombers, you know. So This is what we stand for. As I think Trotsky said in the Learn to Think article of 36. Well, about the Zelensky government, at the same time that the Ukrainian comrades are resisting the Russian aggression, they are fighting against the neoliberal Zelensky projects, government projects. There were an important movement of unions in Ukraine against a new legislation that who will attack workers' rights in Ukraine. And the comrades did both struggles. We are not defending Zelensky government, but against an imperialist invasion, you have to choose about only three options. We cannot be idealists. We need to talk about, we need to be materialists in this debate. You can resist, you can flee, or you can surrender. And what we are defending is that the Ukrainian comrades need to have the right of resist. And this is what happens. And this is why I think it's close, it's similar with another historical situations, because in a lot of another historical situations, the debate of the non-intervention, we are against wars, helped the imperialist power in not only in Spain but in Ethiopia. There's a lot of examples. The only two things, 30 seconds for each other. For each one, the position of don't support this position, don't support the Ukrainian resistance, strengthened the far right in Ukraine, because the far right it's a terrible, but the far right it's one of the a current sector that are defending the Ukrainian self-determination now, when a lot of comrades in the eastern in the Western left don't do this, you know. So I think this kind of if we made a strong support to the Ukrainian left, we could fight the far right at the same time. And to finish, we defend the Donbas self-determination, the Donbas people self-determination too, but all the Donbas people, not only the Donbas people today, because there was an ethnical cleansing in the Donbas, in the Crimea. A lot of comrades in the Donbas and the Crimea were expelled from his homes. So when we talk about the Donbas self-determination, we need to talk about all the Donbas people self-determination.
Perfect. Thank you, Bruno. Next, we have Andrew. Go ahead.
Yeah, just some general remarks. In fact, it is possible to give material support, modest, but material support from a labor movement, networks, and also political organizations, which is also the case of anti-capitalistas, that even they would have different approaches or different nuances supported materially, both Socialny Ruch and the Russian socialist movement with a fundraising campaign right at the beginning of the war. The problem is that the weapons by themselves don't solve the conflict as such. And the problem, in my view, is that there won't be an end to this war without some kind of political agreement. On the other hand, about what Molina was saying, I think that this war has also solved one of the major conflicts among the American ruling class, about what priority to focus against Russia or focus against China. And I think that they've solved the equation saying first Russia and then China, but it's all linked, and it's not, obviously the tensions this summer around Taiwan are also related to the growing international tension. And I think that the whole situation is very dangerous and can go out of control at any time. then the other element is that in all political, all material and weapons aid has always associated some kind of political conditionality by the ones that supply them. So I think that, and I know this quite well, this history, that a major price that the Spanish Republic, especially the revolutionary forces, had to pay for Soviet military support was subordination to Stalinist rule in the last phase of the Civil War in the Spanish case. But I think that when political leaderships are effectively anti-imperialist and able to maneuver among different imperialist contradictions, like it was the case of Tito in Yugoslavia or Ho Chi Minh in Vietnam, they were able to keep a great deal of political independence and agency that escaped the control of these main powers that were maneuvering. And I think that this is something, I think this is a path that the Ukrainian left should try to follow, but obviously through confrontation against a right-wing neoliberal anti-imperialist government that's weakening the rights of labor movement, using this shocked tactic of war, of course, as the Western governments are also doing the same to impose growing budgets, military budgets, cuts in freedom of speech and demonization and of internal opposition. So I think this is the key questions of the situation.
All right, thank you so much. Next, we will hear from Aaron.
Thanks. Let me just quickly start by saying I very much agree with Bruno on the concrete requirements of what material support looks like. I hope that's clear through this discussion, and what not doing that would mean, what the implications of that would mean for Ukraine and the possibilities of building solidarity, and what it means for the relative strength of the right in Ukraine. Also, just very quickly to the comrade who asked the question about Learn to Think, Trotsky was talking about forces in Algeria operating, quote, under the banner of self-determination, just like in Ukraine. He's not talking about Leninist forces. So we should be clear, there is absolutely an applicability of that analysis to the current situation. I want to go to what Philip said about the question of so-called socialists or DSA members in Congress. I mean, you know, this may be an inside baseball for those who are outside of the U.S. at this point in time, but, you know, with one exception, all of those forces essentially just voted in support of Biden and the Democratic Party to scab on railway workers. So the idea that any of these forces are going to be won to a kind of principled Leninist Tribune of the People position in Congress, I think we're just fooling ourselves. Could we come up with a dream list of demands we would like our dream Congress people to be making at the moment? Absolutely. And that could include actively, you know, undermining NATO and demilitarizing bases and calling for support, for military support to Ukraine, and calling for, you know, an end to the debt in Ukraine. I think we need to be modest about understanding about what our position is. And this sort of goes to Evelyn's point. I'm not arguing we shouldn't support arms to Ukraine, just the opposite. I'm just speaking to, you know, where we are realistically at this moment on the left. We're not in a position in Congress to be making any real demands or control at that level. There was a very concrete experience earlier this year where independent trade unions in Ukraine and the comrades in SR, the social movement in Ukraine, were lobbying the AFL-CIO in Washington to back the demand of Ukrainian trade unions, independent and formal and non-independent, to oppose the government's neoliberalization of the labor laws, and the AFL-CIO, you know, failed that test, not surprisingly. And there's an example of concrete solidarity we could have undertaken, and we need to be able to build for being able to take those actions in the future. The idea that just on the question of negotiations, I just think, you know, Hector, with respect, the idea that diplomacy would have left Ukraine unscathed, I think, is foolishness. You know, diplomacy would have left Ukraine with 20% of its, you know, army and population and territory under Russian control. And its national project completely disrupted under the Putin regime. So what diplomacy are we talking about? And I raise this not to pick on Hector, but to point out that there is actually, and I said this in my initial talk, a very active process going on that we need to keep our eyes on. That's a diplomatic process that's very much about imperial interests and not about the interests of Ukraine necessarily, or certainly about the interests of the Ukrainian forces that we would support. And I think this speaks to the question of the difference between this, you know, this the question of the imperial interests and the questions of the interests of national self-determination. And I take people's caution about, you know, speaking so definitively about, you know, what Ukrainian people want or don't want. But I'm glad Denis was here. And I think we need to do, my point is, I think we need to be much more active in building that solidarity in those networks so that we can more readily hear what those comrades have to say. Finally, to John Molyneux, I think there are implications for the future. And very quickly, in particular in the South China Sea, and in the context of the uprising in China and what's gone on in Taiwan, the analysis about building those solidaristic internationalist networks from below in Ukraine applies just as much to the comrades in Taiwan and just as much to the comrades in China who are actively, you know, in the midst of their own fight. That if we want a future where we're able to sort of challenge, have a force that can actively challenge the imperialist system, it's going to require us rebuilding those networks as an international left and not just, you know, be in our small, weak ghettos in the West. Thank you very much to the comrades. This was a very productive discussion.
Thank you, Aaron. And then we'll wrap up with Paul's contribution, followed by, I'll make a couple concluding remarks before we close. Go ahead, Paul.
Thanks a lot. And I do think it's been a very valuable, real engagement, dealing with each other's, you know, real ideas rather than straw men and so on. So we should do more of this. If you look at Karl Liebknecht's famous speech in the Reichstag, where he spoke against war credit supporting German imperialism in World War One, you know, the most famous part of that speech is the main enemy is at home. But there's another part of the speech where he says, and he emphasizes it over and over again, he says, learn everything, forget nothing. And what he's arguing against is the German propaganda is focusing on the latest atrocities against Germany, whipping people up and saying, this is outrageous, we have to fight back, et cetera, et cetera. And he's saying, no, we have to look at this in its historical context. We have to look at it globally. We have to look at the crimes of German imperialism as well. And I think there's something very important for us there, which is to refuse to accept that we only see it in the very narrow lens that some people want us to primarily see it in, which is the horrific events since February, the absolute horror that is being inflicted upon the people of Ukraine. I want to really extend my solidarity to Dennis and the other comrades in Ukraine, but to refuse to look at it in the global context of rising inter-imperialist tensions and now an active inter-imperialist conflict. And, you know, I do think that's the fundamental difference. I don't know, Aaron, in this, at the start, said he does agree there is an active inter-imperialist conflict, but he certainly doesn't place any emphasis on it. Bruno doesn't place any emphasis at all on it. Like, in my opinion, that's the difference with Trotsky's historical or his hypothetical situation in Learn to Think. He's not talking about an inter-imperialist war, whereas this is, it's not just a proxy war. It is actually a real imperialist invasion, a war of national liberation and so on. But it is also an inter-imperialist conflict. And I think that has consequences for those of us in both of those camps, and the need to say the main enemy is at home, to oppose our own bourgeoisie, while also obviously opposing, you know, the other imperialist side, and in this case, emphasizing support for the Ukrainian people. And so, like Bruno says, this is a principle, this is a principle, this is a principle. But, you know, when Serbia was invaded at the start of World War One by the Austro-Hungarian Empire, you know, even Lenin says, for the people there, it's a continuation of the national liberation struggle. They've been invaded by an imperialist power. He says 1% of the conflict is now a national liberation struggle. But it isn't the end of the question. It's like there would have been people making the argument about Belgium later on in World War One that looked at the rights of small nations and so on. And I'm not saying only 1% of the conflict here is an imperialist invasion. I think it's much more than that. Although I think the balance is shifting more and more towards being an inter-imperialist conflict as more and more weapons and so on are poured in. But like, in my opinion, that's the crucial difference. So that's, I do think, the underlying difference of analysis, and also similarly in terms of the Spanish Civil War and so on. In terms of John's question of what is the agenda of US imperialism in a more concrete way, I think that's interesting. I think knocking Russia back, now bogging Russia down in a long war for which the Ukrainian people pay the main price, is a significant element. I think establishing hegemony over the European capitalist classes is a part of it. You know, in the past, EU militarization was a project which was partly in conflict with the agenda of US imperialism. There was tensions with it, whereas now it's fully integrated under the banner of NATO with clear US leadership. And I think then preparing for battle in terms of China is the other key factor, as Andreu said. And I think that brings to the other interesting question. I'm sorry, I can't get to very many of the questions, but that John raised about the consequences about this for the future in terms of the left. And I think there are consequences. I mean, I think this is not a World War One moment from my perspective in terms of the division of the left. But if it continues and we continue to have significant differences while the world goes deeper and deeper into inter-imperialist conflict, then I think it can become something more like that moment. Like, you know, already, I think the outlines of significant differences over how you would react to what would happen in Taiwan. If the US... if China invades Taiwan and there's a response by the US and similar type situation happened around Ukraine, I think Aaron is saying that like he'd have a similar type position. He'd be in favor of weapons to Taiwan and so on. And I think like that would put him in his imperialist camp, in the imperialist camp of the US, in the context of, you know, a Cold War that is becoming a hot war and so on. And I would say a same sort of approach here, that you support the Taiwanese people right to self-determination and so on, but you have to oppose the inter-imperialist conflict, because I think this is going to more and more be a dominant feature of the world situation. So I do think orienting ourselves is important. So therefore we should continue the discussion. Thanks.
Thank you. Thank you so much, Paul, and all the other speakers, everyone, for being here and participating in this, in a comradely debate. I think this has been really productive. Just a couple of words before we close the actual call. If you enjoyed this, I should plug the organization that organized it. This meeting was organized by MORE, Marxist Organizing for Revolutionary Eco-Socialism. We're a collective made up of Reform and Revolution in the US, RISE in Ireland, and Lernen im Kampf in Germany. Each group is different and unique, but we have come together around a couple of agreed documents, which should be available on our new website soon. In advance, I can tell you that some of our common key features are that all three of our groups work as a Marxist wing in broader left projects. So DSA in America, People Before Profit in Ireland, and Die Linke in Germany. We do this as we think the task of Marxists is not to build isolated sects, but to build a revolutionary socialist wing of the existing movements. We believe this principled mass work or united front work is crucial for socialists working with others to build genuinely mass movements, but also ensuring that within that we push socialist and Marxist ideas. Secondly, all our groups lay an emphasis on the need for democratic organization, rejecting the bureaucratic centralism of much of the revolutionary left. We believe that it is only through discussion and debate involving all members in the decision-making process that we can truly develop the Marxist organizers that we need. And finally, we're eco-socialists. We believe that the climate crisis is a crisis of capitalism, and that the single biggest issue we face is that climate crisis. As eco-socialists, that means we argue that the environmental movement must be socialist, and the reverse, that the socialist movement must be environmentalist. And that's it. So just everyone, again, thank you for being here. As a reminder, the recording will be available on the Reform and Revolution website, reformandrevolution.org. And the Rupture Radio podcast in the coming week. Thank you so much, everyone. This has been great.